people from the age of about 20 to 40. We can't reach this age group, and they're the largest age group, and they are incurring the most injuries and fatalities, generally speaking, more injuries probably than anything. Older people, as a rule, unfortunately, are generally the ones that are the highest number of fatalities, because for them, when they receive an injury, they're much more fragile to begin with.
That's Cynthia Brown, Executive Director of the New York Coalition for Transportation Safety. And this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, talking with innovators and experts about healthcare in America. Cynthia Brown is on a mission to design and implement programs that reduce injuries and fatalities resulting from motor vehicle crashes. In addition to leading the New York Coalition for Transportation Safety, she is the administrator of the Queens, Nassau, and Suffolk County Traffic Safety Programs. She works collaboratively with other agencies, including the Long Island Health Collaborative, Safe Kids, and AAA, to educate the public about New York State laws as they pertain to pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorists. Cynthia Brown, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to start by just saying I was unaware of the fact that the New York State Coalition for Transportation Safety was founded jointly by the Medical Society of the State of New York and the American Association for Automotive Medicine. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how that coalition came together and really how the involvement of the medical establishment really positions the organization this issue as a public health issue.
Well, initially, we were the New York Coalition for Safety Belt Use, which is the name we're actually incorporated under. And it was formed back in, 1982, actually before my time. And it really was to combat or institute something that would stop the number of motorists who were being killed in car crashes because they weren't, or there was no safety belt in automobiles. And so what happened was the automobile industry actually formed the coalition. At the time, it was the five major American automobile makers, and they were on the original committee. And I would like to say that there was a very altruistic reason for their doing this, but it was really because they didn't want to, they wanted to use seatbelts and put them in cars, to cut down on the number of deaths, but also because they saw airbags coming down the pike and they were very expensive to put into cars. And if enough states in the country passed a seatbelt law, so there was an organization such as mine in every state in the country in 1983 or 84. And there is still not a New York State, the seatbelt law is a primary offense. If you're not wearing your seatbelt, the police officer can stop you. In a lot of other states, it's a secondary offense, which means if you get stopped for, let's say, speeding or some other reason, and you're not buckled, they'll give you a ticket for that also. And so in July of 1985, New York State became the first state in the country to pass a law for seatbelts. And one of the reasons that it passed was because we had approximately 150 different organizations, many of which were health organizations, who supported this because they saw so many injuries and deaths as a result of people not being restrained in an automobile or a motor vehicle of really any type. And if you think about it, if you were involved in a rear-end crash, you hit the dashboard or, whatever. And if it was the front end, you went through a windshield, there were terrible consequences. And since the law passed, which is many years ago now, it went into effect in New York in January 1. And there was a 6-month phase-in period. And so after that, real efforts were made to do with enforcement. Obviously, because if there was no enforcement of the law, then nothing was going to change. And cars all at that point in time had seatbelts in them, and some had kind of crazy things to remind you to buckle up. I think now it's just a little light on your dashboard, but it had sounds and bells and whistles, and the car, you know, wouldn't want to do certain things. And but anyway, about 3 or 4 years after the seatbelt law passed, the top end car manufacturers, like let's say Mercedes, began to put or had airbags in their cars already. And at one point in time, some probably late 80s or early 90s, Ford put airbags in the cars. And the whole point about states needing seatbelt laws sort of became moot, because once Ford put them in, everybody put them in. So now, you know, we have seatbelts in cars, but there are still, the federal government and state government still do extra enforcement for seatbelt use, you know, 2 or 3 times a year. They'll stop, you know, cars just to check to see if people have their belts on. And in New York State, the usage rate is between 90 and 93%. So it's pretty good, and it really has cut back drastically. The number of people who died in 1980 or 85 compared to now, the numbers really did go down. Between enforcing drunk driving laws and wearing seatbelts, we were able to cut way back on the fatalities.
That's fantastic. And as you just pointed out, the adoption rate in New York State is close to 90%.
Yeah, it's very good.
So that tells us that 1 in 10 adults still does not use their seatbelts, despite the fact that I know my car will chime at me until that seatbelt is clicked, and it's annoying. So what do you think is kind of preventing those last holdouts from getting on board? And do you think you'll ever kind of achieve 100% compliance?
They're probably the same people that don't want to get vaccinated. I had a gentleman who actually operated an automotive business tell me once that he would rather be killed and ejected, whatever, from a vehicle than have to put on a seatbelt. Wow. So if you, and I said to him, but because he felt that the seatbelt might save him, but it would ultimately wind up in his being paralyzed. It's really hard to persuade people who think this way.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, it is, I not to interrupt, but we find that there are a lot of young people today not doing it. And I don't know why, because they all have probably been buckled up with an inch of their life from the time they were born in a car seat. So if it's just a type of rebellion, or if they're lazy, or I don't think that there's a real good reason for why they do it, other than they perhaps enjoy risk taking. So yeah, which a lot of younger people do. So,
unfortunately, that's true.
Yeah.
So your organization, after passage of that landmark legislation in New York State, has sort of evolved to now look at other issues that pertain to transportation safety.
Right. That was actually when we changed the name to, cover a much broader part of traffic safety, not just seatbelts.
So what are some of the other issues that you're engaged in?
Well, we've done a lot of different things, but more recently, we work with a lot of through the county exec's office and the borough president's office. We have very good connections to other organizations like senior organizations, schools, civic associations, different types of good government organizations. And we go by, it's data driven. It's what we see as the most people being injured through what type of a crash. If are they in a vehicle? Are they outside of a vehicle? And in the last, I would say probably 10 years, we've really, really, really encouraged people, even young people, to walk and bike, because we see so much diabetes and, you know, occurring in younger people, and the exercise is very good for it. The federal government had a program called Safe Routes to School, which was intended for younger children and up to eighth grade. And it encompassed everything from getting them off of a school bus so they would walk, to, you know, reducing pollution because you wouldn't need as many school buses. And you know, teaching them safety on the street when they were walking, to go out groups and different things. And it was a pretty successful program, but like anything else, when you don't keep reinforcing it, it goes away. And people have very short memories.
So in terms of pedestrian safety, New York State ranks 7th in the nation in terms of pedestrian fatalities. And Long Island, where I live and where you're based, is known to be one of the most deadly regions for pedestrians. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think once you get outside of Long Island, New York City, Westchester, maybe Southern Rockland, and in the western part of the state, probably Buffalo, I don't think anybody is out walking. And New York City in particular has done, you know, they have Vision Zero. They have done all kinds of things to try to reduce the number of pedestrians. And truthfully, they really have, because when I started, the number of pedestrians killed in New York City annually was around 350. It was more than the number of people killed in a motor vehicle, you know, as a result of a crash. Mm-hmm. Now it's about 120. So a lot of the things that, you know, the efforts that they took were successful, and they have an inordinate amount of bicycle lanes, but many of them are protected bike lanes. Those don't exist on Long Island and Nassau and Suffolk. It's there's a program or a law really called Complete Streets, which means that when a government is a county or a local government is redoing a street, they're supposed to take into account the needs of all the users of those streets. So it should include a bike lane, and it not even necessarily a protected one, but a bike lane. It should include, you know, clear markings, roadway markings for pedestrians to cross streets. The signals should be user friendly. There aren't very many of these going on. I mean, we're lucky we get the potholes fixed. So there's very little, you know, complete redoing of the roads. And also in Nassau, more so I think than even than Suffolk, at the point in time that highways, going back to, I don't know, Moses, Robert Moses, if you want, those roadways cut through areas that split up neighborhoods. So as a result, you have an area now like Village of Hempstead. And it's densely, densely populated. It has the railroad station, it has the bus terminal, it has the courts, it has municipal parking. And all of this is within about 6 square blocks. It has a lot of public housing, and it has a lot of people with disabilities. So you'll find that most of the pedestrian and even bicycle injuries are occurring in places that were originally designed to be like a hub, you know, for like a little city, and got divided up by roads that, you know, came in, made it very hard for people to cross streets. They're like boulevards, even if they're not highways. And so it tends to make it more difficult, and then people take chances when they cross. And a lot of the people who live in those in the vicinity of those areas are lower income people who have to walk to get to public transportation or ride a bike for work. So it's unfortunate that that's the way things have played out. So that's one of the reasons that. And also, there, like I said before, there's very little in the way of protected bicycle lanes. So this, once with the advent of COVID, many, many, many people took up bicycle riding. And so while pedestrian deaths, I think, generally were down, bicycle deaths are and injuries are up.
So you mentioned bicycle lanes. Are there other strategies that like rural and suburban communities and even urban communities can implement to create safer spaces for walkers and for bicyclers?
Yes. If it's a new road that they're putting in, well, first of all, just sidewalks, period, is a big help. Even if you're not really legally supposed to ride your bike on a sidewalk, it's still much safer for people to walk if there's a sidewalk. a lot of people don't know the laws. Pedestrians, for example, if there isn't a sidewalk, they're always supposed to walk facing traffic. And many of them don't because they're just, I don't know, don't want to take the time to cross to the other side of the street, or they're afraid to cross, or they don't think it makes any difference, but it makes a huge difference. Pedestrians always walk facing traffic. Bicyclists should always ride with traffic. That being because a bike or a person riding a bike, that's considered the same as a motor vehicle. So they have to obey the same regs as drivers do. And there is a route, I believe it's 347 in Suffolk County, where they, I guess, redid the road, or it was a new road, and they put a great bike path in because it's actually up off the road, but it runs exactly parallel with the road. And, you know, it's laid out for bicyclists, and it's obviously, you know, a very safe way to travel. There's so many different ways to mark what's a bike path. I don't even want to go into it here. And some just say bike route, which doesn't mean that it's intended for bicycles. It just means that's the way you go if you're riding a bike. So there's a lot of those in Suffolk County. So that's not particularly safe, you know, for a bicyclist. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons that a lot of the people who are killed are, like I mentioned before, people who use their bike. There are a lot of delivery people, that kind of thing. And they actually go back and forth on their bike. So it's, you know, it's not a good situation.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that, because I love to ride my bike, but I will not ride on the roads on Long Island, because I just find that, to my mind, the drivers are very distracted. And I don't know if cell phone use in the car has contributed to that. What are some of the factors that you think contribute to?
Well, definitely cell phone use. I mean, you see it, it's the most obvious at a traffic signal. You know, you stop and the car ahead of you is stopped. And then you all of a sudden you see they don't go when the light changes and their head is down. It's a very difficult law for police to enforce because they can't see it. And the way New York State law is written, it isn't against the law to while the car is stopped for you to be using the phone. So people pick it up, you know, with the while they're waiting for the light to change, they just forget to start. But even worse is the pedestrians who are doing it as they're crossing the street. They just look down at that phone and they're oblivious. It's frightening. And it's really hard to track, because unless you can get a hold of that cell phone, a police officer would not be able to know definitely that person was on the phone. Mm-hmm. So the data on, you know, how many people are truly on the phone when they're either walking or driving, it's probably very underestimated. Underestimated.
Absolutely.
Some of the other things that contribute greatly, especially, and this applies to bicyclists and pedestrians again, is many people, we have so many local train stations on Long Island, you know, from the Long Island Railroad, and people who take a bus. And at certain times of the year, when we turn the clocks back and it gets dark much earlier, 3/4 of people out there are wearing black for whatever reason, and no one thinks about how hard it is to see you if you're in a car. And so, particularly if it's bad weather, it is almost impossible to see a pedestrian or a bicyclist. Easier to see a bicyclist, actually, because by law they're supposed to have reflectors at front, back, wheels, you know. People don't have any reflectors. So we, when we do presentations, we'll give out reflective wristbands. There are all kinds of armbands, things you could put on the outside of your coat. And it's generally the color of what you see, you know, when people are working on the roadways, the reflective gear that they wear when they're out there. So we try to do something like that. We try to do a little street education outside of intersections that we know are particularly busy, or outside of the bus terminals or the train stations, just to hand out things that tell you what the laws are for pedestrians and recommendations on how to stay safe. You know, even if you use your cell phone, you can put it on the flashlight, and, you know, just so that somebody can see you. And because it's really one of the leading causes of pedestrian deaths, and the motorist just doesn't see them.
Yeah, it's a way to save your life. Well, it's time for us to take a brief break, but listeners, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more with Cynthia Brown.
Healthcare Confidential is brought to you by Prescriptive Communications, LLC. Analyze, strategize, connect. That's our prescription for healthcare marketing. Prescriptive Communications puts healthcare businesses in front of the audiences they need to reach. If you're ready for a diagnostic on your marketing efforts, get in touch with Prescriptive today. Call us at 631-606-0525 or visit prxcommunications.com. That's 631-606-0525 or prxcommunications.com.
Welcome back to Healthcare Confidential. We're here with Cynthia Brown, Executive Director of the New York State Coalition for Transportation Safety. And we're talking about the ways that municipalities really can help keep pedestrians and bicyclists safer on the roads. And I noticed that you mentioned earlier that there are some hubs in certain villages, and these tend to be areas that are densely populated, lots of seniors, sometimes low-income people. And I know we talk a lot about on this program about healthcare disparities, but there's also disparities in pedestrian fatality rates, right? So who are the groups that are most at risk for these kinds of incidents?
Well, just on numbers, and it this is really the hardest group to reach. I can reach school children, anybody who's of an age that can go into a school if the school is willing to do a program, you know, to bring us. And I'm not saying it's the greatest, you know, thing in the world, but they, generally speaking, we will go into schools where there has been an incident. And so those children are much more receptive to hearing this. And then there are many senior centers. And as we get older and we become more careful about what we do anyway, the seniors like to really get into lively discussions about this kind of thing. And they're very quick to tell me exactly what everybody else is doing wrong. But people from the age of about 20 to 40, we're not allowed to do advertising campaigns. We cannot pay for advertising. So without a single place other than the internet to go on and advise, we can't reach this age group. And they're the largest age group, and they are incurring the most injuries and fatalities, generally speaking, more injuries probably than anything. Older people, as a rule, unfortunately, are generally the ones that are the highest number of fatalities, because for them, when they receive an injury, they're much more fragile to begin with. So while they may not be, struck down and die immediately, they may die. There was a case of it happens to be right close to where I live, a woman, 82 years old, struck by a hit-and-run driver on Sunday, and she died yesterday. Mm-hmm. So it's that type of thing, you know. So, but again, I have a better shot at reaching older adults than I do the group in between, who are probably the ones that are really the risk-takers and doing the hit-and-runs, which have just gone through the roof. I mean, for every person that stays, I think there were three that now leave. Wow. And as one gentleman on one of the newscasts said last week, there was a very severe accident with a young woman who struck somebody, killed them, and took off. But she didn't get very far because she hit two parked cars. And as the driver said, when she was arrested, she had a blood alcohol level, not that high, but enough to be above the legal limit. And she had an invalid driver's license. And that's why a lot of these people don't stop, because they don't have, you know, your driver's license could be invalid just for not paying tickets. It doesn't necessarily mean that you had, parking tickets. It doesn't have to be, you know, or you didn't renew your driver's license when you were supposed to. So these are all reasons why people do it. But it's an epidemic. It really is. So.
And- And you mentioned, you know, that she was under the influence. And I noticed that recently there was some media attention around this issue of walking while drunk.
Yes, drunk walking.
Drunk walking. So clearly it's more dangerous than walking sober. But can you put this issue into perspective for listeners? How dangerous is it really?
You know, I didn't even realize that this was an issue. I never thought about it. I don't do much drunk walking myself, but I think with the advent of Uber, and so people leave their cars home because they think they're going to go out and have a drink, and they think they're perfectly safe to, you know, call a service or walk home if they don't live far. But they don't pay attention when they're drinking. And they're very careless about crossing streets. You know, you have the right of way as a pedestrian if you're in a crosswalk in Nassau and I think parts of Suffolk County. If you want to get a walk light, you must push the signal. Well, I can tell you right now that most of the people who have had too much to drink probably can't even find the signal. And if you don't push the signal, you'll never get a walk light. And on a lot of these traffic lights, you have to push it. The light will turn green, but you won't get the little icon that shows you the person that says to walk. So I think that, and again, in these areas that are more congested, there are more bars. Mm-hmm. And in areas that are a little more remote, the bars are along roads without sidewalks and they're, you know, a little further apart and people feel they're being safe and they want to walk home. But they're really not in good shape. So the same thing years ago, I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving came up with a slogan that said something like, don't let a friend drive drunk. And then they also had another one, arrive alive, and you know, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. I think we need to come up with some kind of a campaign for people who walk because they think they're doing the right thing anyway, which probably they are, but they're doing harm to themselves.
Yeah. I mean, they're definitely safer
probably. You know, that age group, 21 to 49 or whatever, and
right.
It's hard to reach.
But at the same time, safer than getting behind the wheel, for sure.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about what your feelings about some of these new toys that younger people are getting their hands on, electric bikes, mopeds, scooters, dirt bikes, ATVs. What role do they play in the risk of injury?
Well, the ATVs in particular are mostly children up to the age of about 16. And they have really, I was doing a program in the Village of Babylon 2 weeks ago. And we actually had somebody there recording it. It was on the local news. And there's a whole group of kids going up and down the street doing wheelies on ATVs. They don't wear a helmet. They are going at a ridiculous speed. They are driving in and out of cars. And now, I can't even believe this, they're doing it in New York City in places. And they're not motorcycles, so they don't come under the laws that cyclists are required to ride because in New York State, a motorcyclist has to wear a helmet no matter what age they are. In New York City, in Nassau County, they have to be up to the age of 18, they need to wear a helmet, and the rest of the state, it's 14. So the law is different all over the place. But the thing is, with the other, like the scooters, they're almost all young people who are riding these motorized scooters. It looks like one you used to pedal with your foot years ago, but it's not, it's electric. And they can go very fast. And you can get one for less than $500. And a person I know who works on motorcycle safety said that, you know, parents just thought this was a great thing to go out and buy their kids for Christmas, but the child doesn't put a helmet on. On a device like that, if they fall, they tend to fall backwards. So they hit the back of their head so that it should even be a different type of helmet they wear. And but the e-bikes are now available in certain locations that you could rent them, the same as if you would, you know, go to a bike rental place or like City Bike. And then they have some that are called power-assisted bikes, which are like half electric and, you know, half pedal power. And then they have mopeds and they have scooters. And the state passed a law a year ago saying that these devices were legal because up till that point in time, if someone was riding one of those little not the scooters, but the mopeds and whatever, they were illegal. They confiscated them. But then they said, no, it's okay, because so many people use them for work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and those are expensive. They're probably, you know, $1,500 and up, depending on how glamorous and fancy a one you want to get. But some of them go 50 miles an hour, and others are limited to 30 miles an hour. And they're all riding in the same lane with you who are walking, and regular bicyclists, and, you know, whatever. And they're in other parts of the country and in other parts of the world. These devices are becoming a primary source of transportation. You don't need gas. You do have to charge them. They're considered very green, mm-hmm. but nobody teaches you how to ride them. There's currently a lawsuit for a young woman who was killed on one. I believe it was with Rebel was the one. It was in the city. She was a newscaster for CBS. She was on the back of the bike. Someone else was riding it. It was one of these little green scooter things that you see. And she fell off backwards and she died.
Yeah.
And he was making a turn.
Well, it sounds as if your work is not going to be finished anytime soon. There's always something new coming along. So I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential, Cynthia Brown of the New York State Coalition for Transportation Safety. Can you tell our listeners where they can learn more?
Well, we have a website, which is just nycts.org. There's plenty of information there. With the Health Collaborative, we have a website called Walk Safe Long Island, and that's got all the laws and information, you know, that you want on it. And they could just email me at cbrown@nassaucountyny.gov.
Perfect.
And I can give you a phone number, too, if you want.
Sure, go right ahead.
This is the office number. It's 516-571-6808. And just ask for me.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you again. And I want to also remind our listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available every Monday morning wherever you access podcasts. Our show is brought to you by Prescriptive Studios and is hosted on Omni Studio. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by Patrick Bukarsik, and our production assistant is John Roy. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.
Thank you.